From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Mike Stice has worked in the energy industry all over the world and once led ConocoPhillips Qatar. He has watched as countries used oil revenues for different purposes, in the United Arab Emirates for tourism, or in Qatar for technology.
Everybody has a different way of using the wealth that comes from this resource, but it's important that it not be squandered. It's important to recognize it is a finite commodity.
But first I'll talk with Joshua Landis about the ongoing military operations against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, as well as recent anti-corruption protests this past week in Russia.
If America just takes the city, turns it over to these militias, there's going to be widespread human rights violations.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Joshua Landis, let's talk a little bit about the Middle East, maybe a tale of two cities, if you will. We've got operations going on in Raqqa, Syria, as well as in Mosul, both with the same intent of ousting ISIS. How are these situations unfolding, and why are they taking so long? I think there was an anticipation, particularly with Mosul, that this would be a short situation, and it hasn't been.
These are the two capital cities of ISIS, Mosul in Iraq, Raqqa in northern Syria. They're separated by hundreds of miles, but they're similar cities. They are big cities. Mosul was a city of well over 1 million people. Today, we believe that there are at least 400,000 or 500,000 people that are still held hostage by ISIS in half of Raqqa. They're not being let out. ISIS is using them as a human shield.
And this is the case in both of these cities.
And it's the case also in Syria. In Iraq, our strategy is fairly clear, which is to arm up the government of Iraq. And of course, Iran is arming up Shiite militias, which have been pounding Mosul. We know who our partner is. We're taking it back for the government of Iraq, who is then going to occupy this city. The trouble is that the government of Iraq is quite sectarian. The Iraqi army is Shiite. Mosul is a Sunni city. It went over to ISIS because ISIS is Sunni, and people embraced ISIS as a better alternative to this government.
Which it clearly hasn't been. There have been attacks, they're being used as human shields, but they are also fearful of the liberation that they may hope is coming?
Well, absolutely, because many of them collaborated with ISIS. Many of the Shiite tribes that are populating the militias, 10% of their men were killed by ISIS. Some of them marched out to pits and shot in the back of the head. So they're looking for revenge. They don't trust people who say, oh, I didn't have anything to do, I was forced into cooperating, so forth. They want revenge. They want to clean out potential ISIS people. And that's the danger for America. If America just takes the city, turns it over to these militias, there's going to be widespread human rights violations, which there already have been in towns that have been conquered in back of Mosul. The same problem lies in Syria. Raqqa is even more of a hornet's nest, because we don't have a partner, a local partner. The partner we do have are the Kurds in northern Syria. They're 10% of the Syrian population. We have armed them up. They're going to be taking Raqqa, which is an Arab city. There is no love lost between Kurds and Arabs. We cannot have them occupy the city for a long period of time, or at least that's what everybody is saying. That leaves America in a very uncomfortable position. Do we leave American troops in Raqqa to be the police, to try to sort out who's a good guy, who's ISIS, who needs to go to jail, for how long, what's going to happen, who's a collaborator? All of those justice issues, we would normally turn Raqqa back to the Syrian government, which is Bashar al-Assad, who is our enemy.
Right.
So we can't do that.
Well, the other big player in this is Russia. What has their role been in terms of Raqqa and in trying to create some sort of balance there?
Russia is backing Assad. Russia wants Syria to be an integral nation by international law, that the UN-recognized government of Bashar al-Assad should retake all of Syrian territory. And they've been supporting Assad. Assad's army has made a race from Aleppo, which they successfully conquered a few months ago, and they've been racing across from eastern Aleppo towards Raqqa. in an attempt to get in on this action and to, as ISIS crumbles, to take as much territory as they can. So America has to make a decision. Do they let Assad, powered by the Russians, come in and scoop up a lot of ISIS territory and divide it up with the Kurds? Or, as many think tanks in Washington are saying, should they build, should America impose an American mandate over eastern Syria and help local Sunni tribesmen build an autonomous statelet? That's a crazy idea. I don't think Trump is ever going to go for it. It would be the human rights correct way to go, is to build a separate nation, do a Yugoslavia, splinter Syria into a bunch of little statelets, and for America to help build a tribal state in eastern Syria.
Well, speaking of Russia, they've got some domestic issues of their own, of course, massive protests in the last week.
How big are the protests? How important are they? And should the United States be beating the drum of human rights and using this, in a sense, to cow Putin?
Well, should they is always a relative question. But obviously, with what's going on here domestically in terms of investigations into Trump's potential involvement or Russia's involvement with the Trump campaign, it's probably best that the Trump administration stay out of this. But these are some pretty massive protests. We're talking thousands of people in over 100 cities in Russia. And this really goes to show the power of social media. This came about because an opposition candidate for the election, Putin's next re-election that's coming out, he did an investigation of Medvedev, the prime minister, looking at his corrupt lifestyle, or what's been shown as his corrupt lifestyle, with a YouTube video showing that he is living incredibly luxuriously. He has a number of properties. In fact, he has a massive duck house on a lake somewhere. And so many of these protests are going around carrying little miniature rubber duckies as protests. It also shows, of course, the generational divide here. This is a lot of young people that are involved. They're getting together via social media. So there's a lot going on there. Will this actually change anything in Russia? Not in the immediate. Putin still has incredibly high approval ratings, 80% by some accounts. But this is going to show that people are now willing to get out in the streets, that even though there is an oppressive response by some observers, you know, a lot of arrests, over 1,000 arrests, many are saying, that they're willing to get out into the streets. So maybe this is the beginning of some activism in that country, a place where that wasn't all that possible before. So we'll definitely keep an in Russia, who has domestic concerns, but of course has become a renewed power player throughout the world and certainly in Syria. So we'll definitely keep an eye on both of those issues. Thank you so much for joining me today, Joshua.
Well, it's a pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldviews section of KGOU.org, or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU. Next, we'll hear from Mike Stice, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of Earth and Energy. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Mike Stice worked for 27 years as the president and country manager for oil and gas production for ConocoPhillips Qatar, and his career in the energy industry took him all over the world. Today, Stice is the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of Earth and Energy. My colleague Suzette Grelot spoke with him about how energy production plays a role in both economic development and in conflict. Mike Stice, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Suzette.
You have had a long career in the world of oil, and you've traveled and worked all around the world. Obviously know a great deal about this global commodity. So can you just kind of give us some sense of kind of the current state of oil and gas? Because we all watch the news and we know that oil prices have dropped significantly. There are many people that are struggling with that, other than the fact that, you know, gas is cheaper at the gas stations, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it also leads to all kinds of other economic and financial outcomes. So we know about emerging technologies and those sorts of things, but kind of give us some sense of how all of this is hanging together and what we really should know about the oil and gas industry.
To be specific to your question, I think it's important to kind of think about change and how much change has come to this industry in just a few years. I was the chairman of the supply committee for the NPC, National Petroleum Council, in 2003. And embarrassingly, if you read that committee's report, it says that we're out of oil and gas here in the United States. We needed to ultimately create an LNG import business so we can keep the lights on. Energy as late as 2003 was basically a concern of ours. And of course, you can see today we're so wrong with the emerging technologies that we had in our drilling, horizontal drilling, the stimulation techniques that commonly referred to as fracking, the proppants that we've used have basically created a whole new supply of oil and gas. Interesting, you comment to the global nature of the commodity, and there's no doubt that oil and now natural gas in the form of liquefied natural gas is a global commodity. Oftentimes, people want to blame OPEC for the supply scenario that's resulted in lower prices. The reality, lower prices are good for economies. They're good for the typical consumer. The industry has done an enormously great job of embracing these technologies and bringing new supplies in an unconventional way. And the real culprit, if you will, if you want to call it that, for bringing low oil prices, I view it as a positive, but the real culprit is this technology that was born right here in the US of A. And, you know, our unconventional development of shales has brought new supplies onto the market, and that is the primary reason for the low oil prices that we experience today. And instead of referring to it as a culprit, I did that intentionally, I think it's important to see how important those lower prices are to our economies. Further to the point of connectivity across the world, I believe economic ties are the source of peace. And if you will spend time thinking about the benefits of having a global commodity that we all rely on for our energy needs, I think you'll see that there can be as much positive as there is negative associated with its global nature.
I have to push you a little bit on the low price, seeing it as a positive. I mean, obviously, you're coming from an industry where, you know, this may be beneficial, but when it comes to state revenues, I mean, our own state, for example, right, really struggles with the fact prices are so low, our budgets are you know, now out of whack. So, and we're not alone. I mean, there are many, sure, many other states and many other countries that also experience this, and even countries in the Middle East that are going to eventually, Saudi Arabia, for example, you know, has a tremendous amount of cash built up, but is having to dip into that cash because of these low prices and is, you know, could perhaps start to run out of money. So, which will have implications for a very large country with a lot of people and you know, and that has been stable. How do you respond to that? Yeah. I mean, why isn't there maybe a happier medium with higher prices?
Sure. You know, I think it's important to point that too low, it can be problematic, and frankly, too high can be problematic. I think we've seen both aspects. I think you rightly point out the dependence that this state, in particular Oklahoma, has on the revenues that come from this industry. Moreover, you've highlighted Saudi Arabia and others have created a burn rate, if you will, that relies on moderate oil prices. But I think it's important to recognize there is a happy medium, and that it's also important to recognize that some of the technologies that we've developed here in the US of A, those can actually be globalized as well. So I predict that there'll be unconventional developments overseas, just as we've seen here in the United States. But I want to come back to the point of why I think it's a positive. If you let history dictate and read Daniel Yergin's book on the prize, you'll find that time and time again, overall economies have been developed on the backs of, let's call it, reasonable energy prices. Not so low that you bankrupt states that are dependent on it or bankrupt producing nations that are depending on it, but at a price where you can be competitive and you can basically continue to promote the supply of this important resource, but you can also manage the environmental consequences, you can manage the economic consequences of too high a price. And so there's a number, and it evolves because technology changes that break-even price, but there's a number where you want to land, where you get the benefits of both. Enough revenue for these states and or nations, but frankly enough cost that the industry can maintain a good, healthy supply.
Well, it seems like we haven't yet quite found that happy medium around the world. And just to follow up on a couple of issues here, I mean, you very confidently said economic ties are a source of peace, but yet we know that this commodity in particular has not necessarily led to peaceful relations, that there are relations that are quite conflictual because of this. And right, even though the United States doesn't necessarily get a great deal of its oil from the Middle East, it has great interest in the supply coming from that region. It obviously wants to stay very connected. And you can see what is happened along those lines in terms of our involvement, with war in the Middle East, not just because of terrorism and other things, but because of this particular commodity. And then to also suggest that overall economies have benefited tremendously from this resource, there are a number that have obviously not benefited. And I'm sure you're familiar with Thomas Friedman's arguments on this about petrocracies and how, you know, countries that are really dependent on this resource for supplying it and earning their money, that they are also not very good, you know, democracies or serving their people in terms of human rights and freedoms and that sort of thing. So it seems like oil is so combined with all of our political and economic relationships that, again, getting that kind of good middle ground, we're still really struggling to get there.
Exactly. I think that's the point. And, you know, Friedman makes some great arguments. I thought Fareed Zakaria had a good response. When you think in terms of what we're trying to do with regard to world peace, and you think about the promotion of democracies and human rights and things like that, I think it gets quite confusing when you combine it with the economic merits of global oil and economic ties. Having lived in the Middle East over 10 years, I can tell you that most of the strife and the conflict that I experienced was more on a religious basis than it was on commodity or oil prices. There were arguments made that connection was the primary motivation, but from my own experience, I didn't witness that at all. That's a difficult place, a very complex place. A lot of high context conversations are going on between different groups of people. A very complicated place, frankly, for the U.S. to have an effective foreign policy. I've watched our diplomats come in and out of those countries, some with good points, some with bad. I think the reality is I learned living there that we have to be supportive of those nations in that area trying to work their way through their own evolution. But we can't dictate whether or not democracy should be there today or tomorrow. If anything, we've probably pushed our agenda too close, too far, and have resulted in more adversity than cooperation. From my standpoint, I get back to what I do best, which is the oil business and how I develop supply through enhancing technology. And I would tell you that that's all been pretty good news. I mean, the Middle Eastern countries in which I worked, in Qatar and Dubai and United Arab Emirates, those countries have benefited greatly and have taken the resources from that and have used it to spur their economies in different directions. Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum took it the tourism direction. Qatar has taken it in the technology direction. Saudi Arabia is using their money in a different way altogether in its education commitments to its people. Everybody has a different way of using the wealth that comes from this resource, but it's important that it not be squandered. It's important to recognize it is a finite commodity. Even though we seem to have plenty of supply today, it may not always be there. And so I'm back at the point. I think there are more benefits to this global commodity. I think the relationships that come out of this are far more beneficial than difficult. I have great friends in the Middle East as a result of working on oil and gas as a commodity.
That's Mike Stice. He's the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of Earth and Energy. When we come back, he'll talk with Suzette Gerlot about climate change and the finite supply of fossil fuels. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the assistant dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is Mike Stice. He's the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of Earth and Energy and the former president of ConocoPhillips Qatar. Before the break, he was talking with Suzette Gerlot about the role of oil in conflict.
Let's look at the future. Let's look ahead. The future of this commodity. I mean, you know, some have argued that obviously we're going to run out of this very precious resource in the not too distant future. And others are really suggesting, look, this isn't good for our environment either to be extracting and using this kind of resource. So we need, you know, cleaner sources of energy, other types of sources of energy, renewable energy sources. What does the future look like along those lines?
Well, we're fortunate to have this abundant nature of fossil fuel. You may not want to expect to hear this from an oil person, but the reality is I'm of the view that we have to pay a particular attention to the accumulation of carbon in our atmosphere. There is no question anymore that human activity is causing an accumulation. We're at 400 parts per million in our atmosphere today. That's pre-hominid levels, okay? That should be something that gets scientists concerned. It's also more important to recognize that, you know, we've got the isotope marked effect. So we know that the C-13 isotope that's in our atmosphere is telling us that this is coming from the burning of fossil fuels. So no longer is there a debate, at least in the scientific community, as to whether or not the human activity that we've engaged in, namely consuming fossil fuels, is contributing to a large accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere. The uncertainty is it catastrophic or not? And what is it we should be doing about it? My view is we need to put our scientific resources on that question and determine what actions we should be taking now for future generations. As you know, the natural gas development in North America has made us a hero among environmentalists across the world because we've been able to reduce our carbon emissions more so than any other country. So that's been a great positive with regard to carbon accumulation. With that said, the United States is now the second largest contributor to carbon to the atmosphere, but we're on the decline, which is a good news story. But if you look at the accumulation of carbon from a math standpoint, just replacing oil, coal with natural gas is not going to solve our problem. We've got to think more broadly than that. So I think it's clear that we need to be looking at all kinds of energy sources.
So like solar,
renewables
wind.
Are an important part. But I think it's also clear that there's limits, given our current technology and understanding, as to how big a contribution they can make. So I think our focus should be in technology is figuring out how to extend the life of fossil fuels, doing as limited as amount of harm as we can to the environment so that we can maintain our needs for energy, but also bring alongside these renewable sources, which I think can play an increasing role over time. And so, I'm one of these people that are advocating the use of renewables, but I'm also one of these people, I want to solve the problem. The problem is we're seeing an accumulation of carbon that could be problematic. Let's no longer find ourselves in denial. Let's go address that problem.
So just very quickly then, as we end, one thing I didn't hear you mention was conservation or reduced use of these types of energy resources. Is that in the cards at all? I mean, the oil and gas industry, are they saying use less of our stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting about it is, you know, the oil and gas industry gets painted with such a tarred brush sometimes. I mean, I've been in the industry 35 years and I've never heard an oil and gas executive promote demand in that way. In fact, most of the energy consumption has to be with conservation. So we conserve within the refineries, we conserve within our gas plants, we try to develop technology that uses less in our automobiles. Conservation is clearly in the cards.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for being here today and shedding some light on this very important global issue.
Thank you, Suzette.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Mike Stice, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of Earth and Energy. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClelland edited this interview. For Suzette Gerlot and Joshua Landis, I'm Rebecca Cruz. Mm-hmm.